This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The legacy of discrimination of people of color and discrimination of certain religions affects the cities we see today. To explain how and why that's the case, Bridge Magazine's Mike Wilkinson reported on the issue and then, being the data expert he is, put together 9 interactive maps of Michigan cities to show how discrimination of the past impacts housing patterns today. Mike, welcome back.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just fine. You used maps and documents from the government's Homeowners Loan Corporation, an FDR New Deal agency created in the 1930s. What did that agency do?
Well, back in at the height of the New Deal, coming out of the Depression, a lot of homeowners had their homes foreclosed. They couldn't make their payments, and they were losing them, millions across the nation. And so the Homeowners Loan Corp was created to give lenders and the mortgage holders themselves a break. They were buying the bad loans, and they were extending the terms and giving people a chance to get out from underneath the foreclosures. So that was one piece of what was going on at the time. And right about the same time, the Federal Housing Administration was created. And together, these two agencies adopted what many would today would think is crazy, the sociology of the time, which called for exclusion of the races, to separate them, to have all white neighborhoods or mostly black neighborhoods, and even to keep the foreign born away from the longer term Americans, for lack of a better word. This is rooted in government policy that you find in these maps from the late 1930s and in the language of the FHA, which ultimately ended up bankrolling the explosion of the suburbs.
So what kind of language did these agencies use when they were describing these neighborhoods where people of color lived or foreign born?
What they were basically trying to do was create a risk assessment for these areas. You know, today, when you go and borrow money, the risk assessment is based upon your income, your credit rating, the job you have, how long have you had that job. It's not based on whether or not you're black, white, Hispanic, whether you're Jewish or foreign-born. But back then, there was this school of thought by some of the best academics in the nation at the time, people who were at the University of Chicago, the University of Michigan, that felt you could gauge a neighborhood's risk by whether there were those elements, the undesirables. And this is the language you're asking about. On the sheets where the appraisers went through and judged a neighborhood, they wanted to know what kind of inhabitants they were. They wanted to know if there was infiltration. And often after that line is words like infiltration, colon, Jews and Negroes, Greeks and Syrians, the foreign-born, Italians, Poles. But there was a special section that they wanted to know for every area, were there Negroes there? And what you find is wherever that was yes, almost entirely in Michigan in the 9 cities, those areas were redlined. And in Grand Rapids, there's...
Explain redline to us.
Well, so they had 4 different levels. You had the green area, which was considered desirable. You had blue, which was still considered good, but yet not at its peak. You had yellow, which was a little bit of a warning area, and you had red. These areas were areas of higher risk for residential lending. And in Michigan, you know, all the areas that were red weren't just where blacks were, but conversely, where blacks were, almost universally, except for 2 places in the entire state, were red, and those 2 were still considered yellow, which had a heightened risk. That's where the term redlining is. You had these neighborhoods that were deemed higher risk. And then when the FHA comes in just after that and begins a different kind of lending, the Homeowners Loan Corporation was basically picking up failed loans. The FHA was issuing new loans over longer periods of term, but they pick up the same language, the same sociology, where the goal was keep the races separate, keep people of different demographic backgrounds separate, and then we'll all be better off. At least that was the thinking at the time.
And so I guess banks and real estate agents reacted to these government findings?
This is not the first time that the African American in the United States faced discrimination. Forever, they were discriminated by landlords, by real estate agents, by home sellers. What this did, and what experts say, it codified it. It made it the rule of law. And so when banks in subsequent years would redline, they were just doing what the government. It had the imprimatur of officialdom, and it allowed it to continue up until the late 60s, where you had the civil rights movement remove a lot of these housing restrictions that had been in place for almost 30 years.
What can we learn from the 9 interactive maps you put together of these cities in Michigan?
If you go to them and you can see them at bridgemi.com, you can go look at Detroit and you can see those parts of the city that were where the blacks were, where the green and the white were, or the green, the very good areas were. And quite often, it's not one-to-one because obviously the city of Detroit is now majority black. It's not like they were just relegated to stay in one particular area, but you see the echoes and the hints in Bay City or in Saginaw or in Flint where the African-American community was 80 years ago, that's largely where they are now because they were restricted from getting a loan in those other suburbs at the time. You know, in Flint, the black community, I mean, it is a majority black town, but the highest concentration is to the north. The areas where there were fewer blacks, you know, 80 years ago or none, still have fewer now. Because at the time, the banks and the FHA wouldn't insure loans for them to move into an area what would be considered racially disharmonious. So it kind of locked in some of the housing patterns that we see today. And I think it's relevant looking at, you know, here we are 50 years after the riot and the rebellion of 67. A large part of the anger that existed obviously was because of the police issues, but a lot of it also was the housing patterns. The 43 riots, a lot of it was the housing where you had the segregation where the African-American community was locked into small parts of the city and was excluded from others, and especially ultimately the suburbs, where it was very hard for them to break into those housing markets, at least with the backing of a federal loan.
And just a note, Mike put together maps for Battle Creek, Bay City, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Flint, Kalamazoo, Muskegon, Pontiac, and Saginaw. Sounds like a lot of work. So if you're interested in your town, you can probably find it. So where'd you get all this information? How'd you design these interactive maps?
Well, I took advantage of the great work done by a consortium of researchers from Virginia Tech, the University of Richmond, and a couple other institutions, which took these old 1937 maps, which were just static paper maps, and they've laid them over current geography and allowed you to click on neighborhoods and then see what were the appraisers saying about them. It's an incredibly rich data set that allows you to go wherever. I mean, even if you don't live in Michigan, let's say you live in, you know, Columbus, Ohio, or Chicago, you can look at the maps there. It's fantastic work from people who really take serious cartography and making sure that history can come alive so that it's not just a piece of paper. You can actually connect and see, what were they saying? Were there undesirables in your neighborhood? Was your neighborhood lauded because it restricted blacks from it? They allow you to see this and just play around and just go neighborhood to neighborhood, and it's just fantastic stuff that allows everyone today to see there really is a basis to white privilege.
Now, just understanding how racism of the past causes issues today is a start, but are there solutions on how to deal with that legacy?
That's one of the problems that we have today. I mean, there have been a lot of places that have tried to take affirmative steps to, you know, lessen the impact. You have Shaker Heights, Ohio. You have Oak Park, Illinois. But they still run into the legacy of 80 years. I mean, you had these mortgages, which were 30-year mortgages, some were 20 years. And so you've locked in patterns that are harder to unlock. We've created a society in many cases where we've never known if we could live together because we've lived apart for so long. I don't have a magic bullet answer to this. And if you have one and your readers have one, I'd love to hear it. But it's a problem that's going to take a lot longer to solve than it probably took to create.
Mike Wilkinson is a reporter for Bridge Magazine, one of our Detroit Journalism Cooperative partners. And you can find his story at bridgemi.com. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to someone who's been researching this issue for decades. Joe T. Darden is an author and a professor of geography at Michigan State University. Let's start with the main theme of this article by Mike Wilkinson. How can discriminatory practices in the 1930s and after actually have an impact on cities today?
Well, they have an impact because the reason that the situation existed back in the 1930s still exists today in this sense. Whenever we talk about the issue of discrimination, we have to look at it first from the ideology of white supremacy, which is deeply ingrained in white American culture in the United States. And so as long as that ideology exists, and there are those who wish to implement that ideology, you get discrimination as a result of that. So what you have is a situation in which, among most of the white population in the United States, there is the ideology of white supremacy in which some of them hold, and the ideology of democracy in which others hold. These two conflicting ideologies have always been a part of American history. And when one is more powerful than the other, you get discrimination in housing, education, employment, and other aspects of life. when the democracy ideology is more powerful, you get a situation of integration, equal opportunity, and equal racial situations. That is what has happened throughout American history. It still exists down to the present day.
I want to talk about that a little further, but I want to pursue this housing thing. For most families, most of their wealth is wrapped up in home ownership. The house or the proceeds from that house are passed from generation to generation. Why have many families of color often been unable to gain in that scenario?
Well, they're unable to gain in it for the very reason I mentioned. Throughout American history, the institutions that control housing, home ownership, for example, have been in the hands of the mortgage lenders, real estate brokers, and they have been those who have wanted to separate neighborhoods by race and inequality. And they've always done that. They have profited from it, and they have advocated the situation that most white residents do not want to live in the same neighborhoods where blacks reside. And so to carry out the wishes of their particular white population, they have been engaged in aspects of discrimination housing, and they can still do that down to the present day, in fact.
Right. We hear from the Fair Housing Centers in Michigan. They've revealed incidents of discrimination on an all too frequent basis. I don't think a lot of people are aware of that. When you teach your students, how aware are they of ongoing discrimination?
Well, some are aware and some are not. It's always a continuum, and it depends on the life experiences of most of the students. Now, most of the students I teach are white, and most reside in suburban areas as opposed to residing in cities. Those that had some exposure in residential neighborhoods that were integrated are a bit more open to the fact that discrimination housing exists. Those who live in the suburbs and have been isolated, they do not have any understanding that the situation exists. They don't understand why they're able to reside in the suburbs and the cities are disproportionately black and Latino.
After redlining ostensibly ended and middle-class African-Americans followed whites moving to the suburbs, we saw housing values in central cities plummet. That means family wealth evaporates for many people of color. How long-lasting is that loss for a family?
Well, it's a loss that they probably do not get over for generations, because intergenerational transfer of wealth exists primarily through home ownership, in which a family owned the home, and when they pass on, they hand that home on to their offspring, their children, who benefit from it because they're able to have a house immediately when they become an adult, because they essentially inherit the house from their family, their parents. Now, what happened is that years ago, African-Americans did not have the same opportunity. The federal government discriminated against African-Americans in terms of home ownership. They provided opportunity to whites by guaranteeing their mortgage in case it defaulted. They would pay the mortgage, so the banks were ready to lend them money openly without regard to their credit ratings. But they would do that if they would move to the suburbs, where they were essentially more secure in terms of the risk they would take. African Americans could not move to the suburbs because of discrimination housing by landlords, landladies, and real estate brokers. And so that resulted in lower rates of home ownership and lower value of the housing that they could buy. And so they never really gained equality of opportunity when it came to home ownership. And even down to the present day, the home ownership rate of African Americans is less than that of the white population.
In the suburbs, especially the inner ring suburbs, we're seeing segregation just as distinctly as segregation was in the big cities. Why is that happening?
Well, it is happening because the mobility of whites out from the city has been a continuous pattern of moving further and further out. And they've done that. The first location in the suburbs of the whites, they were primarily members from the white ethnic groups, and they settled in the inner suburbs. That was their way to escape the cities, and they could afford the homes there, and that's where they located. Over time, as the people in the city moved to the inner suburbs, they moved further out to the outer suburbs. And they continued that pattern of spatial mobility outwards over time. And so what you have now is that the highest home ownership rates exist in the outer suburbs, the highest quality of housing exists there, the highest quality schools exist there. So that has been a continuous pattern over time. It continues to exist and will probably continue for a long time to come.
When you poll white folks and black folks, each of them say they'd just as soon live near someone of their own color. So I'm wondering, how much is segregation we see in cities such as Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, how much is that chiefly due to self-segregation?
Well, my research doesn't support that argument that all racial groups behave the same way when it comes to preferences to live within one's own group. My research suggests that the only group that has been consistently preferring to live among their own group has been the white population. Among the black population, that is not the case. Among the Latino population, that is not the case. And is also not the case among the Asian American population. And the only group that wants white-only neighborhoods, essentially the white population. The other groups are open to a diverse type of neighborhood, but what they want, and this is a consistent desire among all of them, they want a home at a good value. They want a neighborhood that's high quality. They want a neighborhood with high achievement schools. Now, that is a consistent preference regardless of race, but the other groups can't get that unless they integrate. And so in a sense, that they're motivated by integrating with white population because they can't get that high quality neighborhood, high quality schools, unless they do so.
Among many white folks, there is the belief that discrimination and racism are a thing of the past. We just need to move on. But when you've had generations of systematic racism, how difficult is it for families, people of color, to just move on?
Well, they probably would have been open to just moving on if the situation had ended when we got things like the Fair Housing Act of 1968, when you got the legislation that addressed the issue to some extent. But that has not happened. In other words, what existed years ago continued to exist down to the present day. Only one generation after the other, they continue to carry on those same ideas. And so we haven't really addressed it because the ideology of white supremacy persists. And if it ended when the legislation existed, such as the Fair Housing Act, blacks and others may say, let's move on. But you can't move on when you still have the situation happening again.
The data are there. The research is available. Why, among policymakers, is this inequality largely ignored?
Well, again, a lot of the policymakers still remain white, and their constituents remain white. And so as long as you have that divide by race among the voters, you will get a situation in which the white voters essentially support politicians who support their ideas. And if they hold the ideology of white supremacy, they want a politician to represent that. And that's what you get. And you have that now in the present-day situation. You get it because policymakers are rigidly divided by race and ideology. And that situation continues.
Joe T. Darden is a professor of geography at Michigan State University. Hey, thanks. It was nice to talk to you again.
You're quite welcome.